morning. Welcome to the Revenue Committee. We have a full agenda today. We want to get started. I'd like to welcome the Senate. Glad you could join us this morning to get the final forecast, revenue forecast. So I'd like to invite the folks who are going to present it to come up and give us the news, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, Representative Strobeck, members of the Senate Revenue Committee and members of the House Revenue Committee. For the record, I'm Tom Petowski, acting state economist and professor and chair of economics department at Portland State University. With me today is Sarah Gates, economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. We were to be joined today by Ralph Shaw of Shaw Ventures and also the chair of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, but he got called away to Bend, Oregon, and a little snow in the Cascades prevented him from getting here. The Office of Economic Analysis in the Department of Administrative Services produces quarterly economic and revenue forecasts, and during the legislative session, our June 1 forecast is produced early, May 15th, to provide you with the necessary economic and revenue numbers for your budgetary process. Assisting us in this forecast process, we have two advisory groups. Our first group is the Department of Administrative Services Economic Advisory Committee, consists of 15 economists employed mainly by state agencies. And our second group is the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, a group of 12 economists from academia and private industry. Members of very diverse backgrounds include a venture capitalist, a wheat farmer, a forestry economist, and others. Our report today will start with an overview of economic conditions, followed by a quick assessment of the Oregon economy, and then we'll conclude with Sarah Gates giving you the revenue forecast. And the order of these things is not merely just to keep you in anticipation for the revenue numbers, but really to illustrate the importance that the economic conditions also affect what the revenue forecast will turn out to be. The title of our main publication that you've received in the purple there is called the Oregon Economic and Revenue Forecast. And I want to emphasize this is not two publications. It's not a separate one for the economic outlook and one for the revenue forecast. These two are intimately intertwined with one another, and where revenues are headed, we have to see where the economy is headed. As an example, for better or for worse, Alan Greenspan can move interest rates that can affect Oregon businesses and families, changing profits and incomes, and thus changing tax revenues. So let me just start with a quick review of what's been happening for our economy. We're in a situation right now, at least for the U.S. economy, that it's the best economy in the past 30 years. Amazing shape, very low unemployment rates, lowest in 30 years, fast real economic growth. In the first quarter of 99, we had a 4% growth, very, very quick. And also the federal budget seems to be in surplus and is projected at least to stay there for a few years. Behind this story, it's definitely a consumer-led economy. The stock market has allowed consumers to spend beyond their means. We've been seeing negative savings rates. And on top of that, we've seen spending that has been the strongest in many, many years. For the Oregon economy, if you turn to page one of the press packet, the short summary page, you'll see some of the recent developments that we have for the Oregon economy. Oregon's economy grew very briskly in the first quarter of 99. This pattern of growth, once again, very similar to the U.S. pattern, definitely a consumer-led expansion. We're also starting to see a mild recovery in Asia, and this has been alleviating some of the pain that the manufacturing sector has seen. Job losses, though, continue to be somewhat high in the high-tech sector, but not as severe as we were seeing in the second half of 1998. Forest product agriculture still remain weak, but with some commodity prices starting to firm up, we're seeing, hopefully, some strength returning to those sectors. If you turn to page three, this gives you a little perspective. The Oregon economy, as you can see, grew a little slower than its neighbors in 1998. from February 98 to February 99. Most of this is due to the Asian situation, especially because our manufacturing sectors, including forestry and agriculture, are more sensitive to the Asian economies. And as they started to deteriorate, so did these industries. Down below, though, we see some projections for our trading partners. Our main ones right now are Canada, Japan, and South Korea. As you can see, as we're coming into 99, Canada is still remaining fairly robust. Japan still in decline, but South Korea is starting to show a turnaround with some positive growth. And then into 2000, we should see continued improvement in their economic conditions in those countries. It should translate into better exports for our manufacturing sectors. On page 4, a legend is missing. The dark bars are relative to the Oregon economy. The light bar, or non-colored bar, is the U.S. economy. So we're showing a relationship between the two. And the main point from these three charts that you have on page 4 is you notice the very high growth that Oregon experienced 94 through 97 relative to the U.S. We dropped down in 98. We're returning to some recovery in 99 and then out through the other years. But the story here is that the growth will still be positive, but not such a pace, fast pace, as we were seeing in the mid-1990s. And that's true across the board. On page 5, when we relate to how Oregon is doing relative to the U.S. in terms of the share of income, you can see that things have improved, finally coming into the 1990s, and as we're finally getting up to possibly the 1979 level, but it's been a 20-year time to make it to that point. Then finally, if we turn to page 6, one of the things you want to keep in mind is that our forecast can't really be characterized, I don't think, as being either over-optimistic or being too conservative. We're really trying to find what is the middle road, what we think is the most likely path or road that the economy is going to go down. I want to read you just a quick quote from Alan Greenspan. And even though it's very tough to tell what he says sometimes, kind of convoluted in his words, and this quote is no difference, but I think we'll still see its meaning. The remarkable American economy, whose roots are still not conclusively known, and the Asian crisis that caught us by surprise, among other humbling experiences, have made policymakers particularly sensitive to how fast the world can shift beneath our feet. And the message here is that this is our best look, and your concern is to look over the next 2 years, especially, and the world can shift beneath our feet within that time. So page 6 takes a look at some of the risk factors to the forecast that we're presenting to you. The first one, macroeconomic policies, here we're definitely looking at what Greenspan is doing. And what we see there is not really any policies to even boost the economy further, but if anything, he may follow a policy to slow the economy down a little bit. The outlook right now is that he's not going to make any move next Tuesday when the Open Market Committee meets, although the most recent news that came out today on the Consumer Price Index, the inflation, was up higher than analysts predicted. But still, the word seems to be that they'll probably hold to no change for May, but then August is still in question as to whether they may try to raise rates at that time. If they do so, that would be a slowing on our economy. Under international conditions, I've got mild on both sides here, an upside and a downside. Part of it is that we've already worked in a little, in a sense, increase in those economies doing better, but it's also possible they may come back even faster and sooner, which would be even a little stronger growth. Then again, too, Japan seems to be a real kingpin in this. They have slowed down their expansion policies, and so that if they don't return fast enough, we may see then more of a little downside in our recovery. Inflation, as you've just seen, the consumer price index has come out. Gasoline prices rising very rapidly. The problem there is that the Federal Reserve then reacts to the higher inflation. They are the watchdogs of inflation, and they will try to then raise rates. The stock market. No one's been able to call, I don't think, truly in their hearts, what direction the stock market is going, when the correction is going to happen. People like to talk about October as a wonderful time for a correction just because we had two large ones in 1929 and 1987. But then again, the stock market has really not shown a historical trend of any time in recent history. So it is a 50-50 chance here, I think, on either side whether the stock market is going to help us out more so, go to 13,000, 15,000 for the Dow, or make a serious correction. Consumer spending is really a key here. What we're saying here is that if the stock market does do a little bit better, there's no sense to say that the consumer won't keep spending and keep going. But probably we see it a little stronger on the downside in that the consumer spending is going to decrease, that it just can't stay at a situation where they're spending beyond their income means and having a negative savings rate. That trend just can't continue, and at some point the consumer is going to slow down. Finally, Y2K. This is, by the way, already worked into our forecast. We believe that there's going to be a little boost up in the economy as we start to get close to 2000, as people prepare. There will also be a little downside because we believe that there won't be great disruptions from Y2K, and businesses and households that have built up inventories to get through the debacle that may happen because of Y2K, when it doesn't happen, they will have a lot of extra goods, inventories, and they have to work those off. And so there'll be a little downside. But neither is enough to either cause a huge expansion or to cause a recession. So our basic look at the economy here is that we're going to return to growth. We don't see any recession in the next 2 years especially. But the growth won't be as strong as what we've recently experienced. And so what I'd like to do is, with that scenario in mind for the economy, and these numbers is for the economic forecast, do influence our numbers for the revenue forecast. So I'd like to turn that over to Sarah Gates.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of both committees. For the record, I am Sarah Gates with the Office of Economic Analysis, and I am going to give you the May 15th revenue forecast. And I'd like you to turn to page 7 of your handout. In summary, I just want to give you a couple of insights as to what I'm going to be talking about. For 1997-99 biennial, we've lowered the forecast by $78 million. That does leave us slightly above the 2% threshold for the personal income tax kicker. And in 99-01, we have raised the forecast of combined general fund and lottery resources by $42.5 million, which gives you obviously more to spend next biennia. But before I get into the real details of the forecast, I wanted to go along with this idea of what's the long-term trend for the economy and what's the long-term trend for revenues, since we've been getting a lot of questions of, well, next biennium is fine, but what's going to happen the biennium after that and the biennium after that? How can we plan? So what you see on page 7 are two graphs. So the top one shows you personal income tax revenues, and the bottom one shows you corporate income tax revenues. The gray bar is the May forecast. The white piece on top of the bar is if there were no kicker and no pension refunds, that's what revenues would have been or would be. The black line is the last forecast, the March forecast. As you can see on the top graph for the personal income tax forecast, we slightly raised the forecast for to the 99-01 biennia. But in the long term, the trend is basically the same. We're expecting long-term growth of about 5 to 6% a year in income tax, personal income tax revenues. You can see in 1998 and 1999, and even into 2000, how kickers and the pension refunds have definitely distorted what the true economic conditions would have provided us in revenue. Looking at the bottom of the page, you can see the corporate income tax forecast. And the same thing holds in that the gray bars are the current forecast, the white is the kicker refunds, how much they have subtracted from revenue, and the black line is March. We believe that the corporate revenues have bottomed out in fiscal year 1999 in terms of the downturn due to Asia. We've seen huge refunds going out recently to corporations. Not only have they been taking kicker refunds, but they've also well overpaid their tax year 1997. And so we've had very low collections this fiscal year. We expect that to recover in fiscal year 2000 and hold relatively flat, and then begin to grow more rapidly in conjunction with national corporate profits. If I turn to page 8, the graph at the top of the page is the total general fund, and a similar pattern holds. We're projecting about 11% of biennia in the long term in terms of growth. We've made slight changes to the forecast in the upcoming years, but overall, in the long term, the pattern's the same. If you look at the bottom of the page, you can see exactly how the kicker and pension refunds have distorted our revenue collections. In 95-97, which was an outstanding biennium for revenue collections, actual collections increased 18%. If you'd taken away the kicker effect, it would have increased 23%. This is phenomenal. In the current biennium, we're seeing actual collections only go up by 7%, but we've given out large income tax kicker credit, refunds, credits, and federal pension refunds. If you take away the effects of that, revenues actually would have increased 13%. And then you can see that over time, we're resuming that long-term pattern that we think is going to hold based on economic conditions in the state. I'd like to give you the same kind of perspective on lottery now, since that's also a very important source of funding. If you'll turn to page 9, you can see a comparison of the May forecast with the March forecast. And in the current biennium and the 99-01 biennium, they're very similar. In fact, they're unchanged in the current biennium. But we have lowered the forecast in the 0103 and 0305 biennia. Over the last year, you've probably noticed that we've been gradually pushing down the forecast in those out years. Starting about a year ago, we've really started working hard to analyze the gains, what is really influencing the long-term trends. We can't just assume that revenues are going to go up and up and up forever. Video lottery is not going to continue climbing like it has in the past. This forecast reflects hopefully a final adjustment to video lottery, or the last major adjustment to the video lottery forecast. We took a look at what the lottery plans to do in terms of the number of terminals out in the field, and they are not planning to expand that number. In fact, they're planning to manage it much more closely, and that will reduce the number of terminals in some establishments. Also, based on the mix of games that are currently out there on those machines, we can anticipate that the revenues on a per-machine basis are going to grow that much over the long term. People are getting bored with the games, the machines are old, and there's more competition, especially if we see any more casinos come in. So we've pushed the video lottery forecast down in the out years, and that is what you're seeing with those black bars at the top of the page. And if you look at the bottom of the page, you can see exactly what is happening in terms of we've got declining resources and we're taking more and more chunks of it away so that you have less and less discretion. Most of you, I think, know that we have the Education Endowment Fund, which gets 15%. This next biennium, we're going to have the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, which will get another 15%. Lottery debt service is taking a larger and larger share. And that leaves you with smaller amounts of discretionary resources. And now if you'll turn to page 10, I'll give you the numbers so you can actually know exactly what we're dealing with for the current biennium and next biennium. At the top of the page is the revenue forecast for the 97-99 biennium. General fund resources, which is beginning balance plus revenue, is now forecast to be $9 billion for the biennium. That's a decrease of $76 million from the last forecast. The main reason for that is the federal pension refunds. And when we did the last forecast, we didn't know that Department of Revenue would be placing as much staff on the project as they did, and we thought it would take longer to get those refunds out. So we underestimated the amount of revenue that will be going out. We've paid out approximately $208 million to date. We anticipate that we'll pay out about $225 million this biennium, and then about $5 million next biennium on the federal pension refunds. And those are only the ones that are, under current law, can be refunded. With the lottery forecast for the current biennium, there is no change. We knew with the last forecast how much was going to be transferred in April, and that is the final transfer for the biennium, so only interest income could vary. What this means is that there is a personal income tax kicker currently forecast. We are only $2.6 million over the threshold. That means that we're 2.03% above the close of session estimate. This is a very slight margin. To put it in perspective, we get $10 to $12 million a day in withholding revenues into the Department of Revenue. So it's like a couple hours worth of withholding revenues is how close we are to that threshold. I think you should look at it in terms of we're right in the middle. It could go either way, and it will timing will play an issue. A slight pickup in the economy, a slight slowdown, whether or not the federal pension refunds that we're anticipating all go out or more go out, all of those things can push us one way or the other. And how it actually comes out, we will know in mid-August when we have final revenues through June 30th. And that's when we'll certify and we will be able to say whether there is or is not a kicker. And that will definitely influence how much money is available next biennia. Because if we don't have a kicker, then that everything above the close of session will flow forward into the next biennium as a beginning balance. All of these changes have lowered our ending balance for the current biennium to $329.6 million. That is approximately $78 million lower. We've had a slight change in the amount of reversions, which is what's the difference. Going into the 9901 biennium, you can see at the bottom of the page, your general fund resources have increased by $43.8 million to $10.2 billion. And there are several offsetting reasons for this. We have increased the personal income tax forecast along with our improved economic forecast. We have a smaller kicker forecast, which means that there's smaller refunds going out next biennium. Offsetting that is the smaller beginning balance, a lower, slightly lower corporate income tax forecast, and slightly lower all other revenues. The lottery forecast is slightly lower, $1.3 million. We have $569.1 million in state resources. This means that the Parks and Natural Resources Fund, as well as the Education Endowment Fund, will each receive about $200,000 less in the 9901 biennium than we were previously estimating. It also means that since they are taking a portion of that decrease, actual discretionary resources are only slightly changed. So your total combined general fund and lottery resources are now forecast to be $10.7 billion. That's an increase of $42.5 million from the March forecast, or 0.4% higher. The following two pages in the press packet give you more detail on this table. It breaks out corporate and personal and other revenues. I'm not going to go through this at this time unless you have specific questions. The final page does show what the average taxpayer would get if the kicker actually kicks with this level of being 2.03% above the close session estimate, and that would be about 4.2% of their 1998 personal income tax liability. And with that, I conclude my presentation. Both Tom and myself would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions from committee members? I wonder if you could comment just real briefly on the corporate income tax down 6.3%. It seems like
for the current biennium.
Yeah, that seems like a substantial change. And I thought the last time we were here, the expectation was that the corporate side had sort of bottomed out and was ready to turn up again.
Just to go back, there are a couple reasons for the decrease. One is that we did come in under forecast with the March forecast for the January to March period. We had anticipated that we would be putting out larger refunds for the 97 tax year, but they came in even stronger than we thought. And as a result, that lowers where we start the forecast from, and it carries through the current biennia. In addition, we've updated our corporate profit information, and it was also that influenced how it all flows through in the model. So it's basically due to overpayments and taking of kicker credits is the main reason I can say that it's lower. We anticipate that that's pretty much stopping, but we'll be watching it very carefully.
Right. That was kind of the assumption last time.
Yes.
Any other questions? I know all the members that are going to be back next year are going to be looking at that 3/100% real closely. Okay, Representative Rasmussen.
I just want to make sure I understand the
forecast for a kicker. We plan for a kicker in this coming biennium. We all go, Sunny die in July 1st and all go home. Come in the August forecast, there is no kicker, final decision. There's no kicker. Then amount rolls into this coming budget. Does that kind of make the kick that coming back, years into a kicker situation? It seems like you'll be rolling that kicker forward into the following.
Representative Rasmussen, the beginning balance does not have any impact on whether or not there's a kicker in the next biennium. That always changes, and it's really based on just the forecast of income tax revenues. It has nothing to do with beginning or ending balance.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. It's a good question.
Hey, well, thank you very much. We appreciate your work, and look forward to the next report.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Tom. I think we'll take about a 5-minute recess to let everybody clear the room. We can readjust, and then I'd like to ask all the House members to please stay here because we've got a lot of things to do. Recess for 15 minutes.
Are we going to return to our...
Yeah, we can. Yeah, but we could just throw away the chairs. We can move away. Okay, we're back in session with House Revenue. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2080, the long-term care tax credit. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, it's really fun to be anticlimactic. I mean, you know, you're in here a while ago and it's packed, and then everybody gets up and leaves, and then you get your chance. I mean, you know, it's a wonderful feeling. I wanted to talk a few minutes about House Bill 2080, the long-term care insurance tax incentive. This will provide a tax credit of up to $500 for the purchase of a qualified long-term care insurance policy. This was considered, and this bill came forward as a result of the Human Services Interim Committee chaired by Senator Fisher and Representative Cruz. We spent a lot of time thinking about it. Currently in this state and in this country, the majority of our seniors who find themselves in need of long-term care services are forced to deplete their assets that they've worked a lifetime to save in order to qualify for Medicaid to receive the care they need. Now, why does that happen? I don't think there's one person on this committee who today thinks that they'd like to live the last year or 2 years of their life in a nursing home. People don't want to do that. In fact, I'd be willing to suggest that most of you would probably say that you want to live at home up until the day you die. Talking to my dad the other night, he said, I just hope I go to sleep some night and wake up in heaven. So that's the way most of us think. But the fact is that a large number of elderly people end up in nursing homes. The life savings that they have to be depleted, and then they go on Medicaid. It's totally counter to the American dream. I'll bet your dream... I'll bet your dream is that you earn some money during your lifetime, you set it aside, you're able to pass it on to your children, your grandchildren. What we have done to Americans, I think, is to destroy the American dream. Medicaid, I want you to remind you, was created to be a safety net program for low-income, frail, elderly people. That's all it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a safety net. But because of the rapidly escalating cost of long-term care, along with an incredible expansion of aging populations, the future viability of the whole Medicaid system is, I think, in question.
Senator?
Yeah.
You're talking Medicaid or Medicare?
We're talking about, well, Medicaid is what we're talking about. Medicaid is what we're talking about. Okay? It's the Medicaid part, not Medicare. In fact, a lot of people in the United States, Oregonians included, believe that Medicare actually pays for long-term care insurance, and it doesn't. Okay? So the misconception that Medicare, you know, which will pay for your prescriptions or whatever, will pay for your nursing home, that also leads people not to buy long-term care insurance. Okay? I wanted to illustrate, and if I could, I'll take this over and have this handed out. I wanted to illustrate the way the problem's getting worse. If you look at the chart that you're getting right now, in 1960, for every 100 working people in the United States, there were 64 dependents under the age of 18, and only 16 over the age of 65. Now, if you consider dependents to be those people who are not working, being paid for by taxpayers who are working, look at what happened between 1960 and 1990. In 1960, there were 64 kids, 65 almost, under 18. By 1990, that had dropped to 41, but look at the other end. It had gone from 16 to 20. But look into the future. Look at 2010. There will be only 34, maybe 35, under the age of 18 for every 100 working, but it jumps to 22 almost. Project that out to 1930. Or, excuse me, boy, I've got my own Y2K problem this morning. Projected out to 2030, there'll be 36 children under the age of 18, but 38 people past the age of 65. How in the world will tax-paying citizens through the Medicaid system ever be able to pay for those people? That's why I have for years been advocating a long-term care insurance policy. Excuse me, and I apologize to all the Democrats on the committee, but this is the most Republican idea I've ever had, okay, because I'm trying to get American people to buy their own long-term care insurance, but we've got to incentivize that. I've got all kinds of radical ideas, none of which made it through committee, but this one is a pretty good idea. What it does simply is give a tax credit if you buy a long-term care insurance policy. Okay? I've thrown a lot of stuff at you now. You've got other information that you consider while you're doing this. We have various projections of what it'll cost. The tax credit doesn't have to cost too much if it just gets applied to new policies. Okay, that's the cheapest way to go. Some of you were complaining to me a few minutes ago. If you don't want to do it that way, it costs more money. But we have got to get people incentivized. During the interim committee, I was thinking about the billions of dollars that get spent. Do you realize that 80 to 90% of all Medicaid money gets spent on the last 2 years of life? We like to complain about welfare and mums having babies and all that money that it costs. That's not true. 80 to 90% of the money gets spent on the last 2 years of our lives. The whole national system is in jeopardy. We need to get more people to buy their own long-term care. I just hope you'll seriously consider it. If all we can afford is the least expensive option, that'll only cost $204,000 in terms of the tax credit proposed. Hope you'll give it some serious consideration. I'd be glad to answer questions. Certainly, I've been preaching about this and answering questions for a long time, and would be glad to answer any.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Senator Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, are you concerned that if we extend this tax credit to only new policies that we're discriminating against folks who have been prudent and have already begun to buy this type of
insurance? Yes, I am, in fact, concerned about that. But within existing revenue and so on here, and the battle over tax credits, as I was waiting, some other fine folks were saying, oh, no, you're not here asking for a tax credit too, are you? You know, I mean, there's such a battle for existing revenue. It becomes your decision. It's one time when I'm glad I'm not on a committee. It's a decision that you folks, yeah, I do feel that there's an unfairness to that. On the other hand, or just imagine that somebody bought a policy that had, say, a $200,000 benefit package to it. For every citizen that would buy a package like that, imagine the savings to the federal and to the state, you know, in terms of the Medicaid savings that are there. We've got to incentivize somehow before this whole system goes broke. That's a very serious threat. We've been talking about it. We play with it. But we have done nothing substantial to head off the crisis that's coming, especially when you look at the expanding number of people on this chart that I just gave you that are out there. How are we ever going to, with 100 tax-paying citizens, how are we ever going to be paying for, you know, by 2030, 38 people that are retired and many of whom will need long-term care? We've got to change the system.
Additional questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Representative Shields. The original bill allows for both corporate income tax credit and personal income tax credit, corporate income tax for employers that are providing this insurance. Are you in support of keeping both of those in the bill?
You know, I hadn't thought a lot about that, but I want to do what will help as many Oregonians as possible. So I really hadn't thought about the corporate side as much as the individual side. Again, I would leave that to your wisdom, to the wisdom of this committee that lives in this arena all day, all session, eternally, forever and ever, world without end, amen, whatever.
I knew this sounded like a sermon.
Yeah.
Spoken as only a Lutheran could say it.
There's one.
Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming forward. Do we have a copy of the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, the Dash 1 amendments are amendments that I had asked to be drafted, which would essentially limit the credit to policies first issued after January 1, 2000. I agree, I think, with the sentiment at least raised by the question that the representative from Cedar Mill raised about the possible unfairness here. But in trying to keep some balance with the costs associated with the system with these tax credits, I thought that this was a prudent amendment and one that I believe is generally supported as at least the first step in this avenue. I would say to the committee that I recently had this week, in fact, the opportunity to go to a rehabilitation center in my district and take a tour of that center as part of a town hall that I participated in. And one of the things I was amazed to learn was that because of the cost of this kind of care with so many people on Medicaid and then the limits that the Medicaid people you're allowed to charge Medicaid for this kind of a care, the private pays, those who aren't Medicaid recipients, the private pays are actually subsidizing the costs for the Medicaid payers in the system. And, of course, those costs are borne by all of us through the process. And I just really believe that House Bill 2080, even modified with the Dash 1 amendments, is a good first step towards trying to encourage citizens of the state to plan for what is more and more likely to be an eventual spot where some of us will need long-term care, even if it's for a shortened time for rehabilitative purposes. Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2080.
Ed Williams moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2080. Ed, could you just, before we
take action on this, would you give us what the revenue impact is?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The Dash-1 amendments are effective for policies issued, new policies only issued after January 1st, 2000. In that case, there would be about one tax year's worth of revenue impact, and we've estimated that one tax year of revenue impact is about, would cost about $204,000 roughly.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative, before you.
As the bill is currently written, is there a sunset or a phase out? Or are we just giving the tax credit to people indefinitely?
Ed, can you answer that?
Representative Kapori, I don't believe that there is a sunset provision in the bill as it's currently written.
Mr. Chair.
Well, you get a follow-up question.
Yeah, and it's not to further complicate this issue, I know we've been over, but it seems to me if we're trying to create incentives for people to get involved in the program, maybe we could place a limitation on how many years you can receive this credit so that you get it, give you incentive to get in the program, and then once you've started 5 years to move, I don't know however long, you no longer receive that tax credit. If we're concerned about that.
Mr. Chair, well, we do have a motion before us. We're considering the Dash 1, so that would have to be an additional amendment proposed. Representative Merklin?
I'm not going to support the Dash 1. I think I can't really come to terms with why it would be reasonable to distinguish between people who have started and will start in the future. If the point is to incentivize people getting involved, then we should give a larger tax break when they first get involved and then diminish the size in future years, which we haven't, which is the idea, because last time we spoke about this and I understood it was going to be cost out. We don't have that cost today. I also feel we have the challenge of people would reasonably and simply cancel their current policy and then and purchase a new policy in order to qualify, so I think it's a rather artificial distinction.
Any further discussion? The motion is to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any objection?
I object.
Two.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very supportive of the purpose of this bill. I have a difficult time accepting the fact that the Dash 1s will, in this sense, discriminate against people who have been prudent already in terms of buying this kind of a policy. Because of that, I'm going to object to the Dash 1.
One, two, three, four, five. Any other objections?
Here.
Mr. Sherling?
I would, Mitchell. Let's see me to it. Needs five?
Well, if the amendment is to be adopted, sure.
This is kind of a difficult choice. One, I don't like the discrimination, but on the other hand, we can't afford the full impact. And so I'm torn here, and I don't much like either choice.
Mr. Chairman?
Hey, Whip.
I don't want this legislation to die. Now, I would also say that I see a credit, like the credit being offered in House Bill 2080, frankly, as being an investment. Not only is it an investment by the policyholders in terms of providing for their own future, but the credit is also an investment on the part of taxpayers and government to make people financially able to provide for their care when they need it as senior citizens. Otherwise, these folks are thrown on to Medicaid or Medicare, and their coverage is Medicaid, actually, I think, in terms of long-term care. And their coverage is coming at the expense of taxpayers. I think this is a very, very responsible and prudent investment. I don't want to see the bill die. I don't want to see the bill die over the Dash 1s, but I would prefer to see the bill move as it was written without the Dash 1 amendment.
Well, the way I read the votes going now, the Dash 1s are not going to be adopted, so it looks to me like we either have people change their minds and adopt the Dash 1 or move the bill as originally written, which has a $4 million impact for triennium. So,
this is
the will of the committee. Dan Merkley.
I would request the chair to bring this back so that we could get a process estimate. I'm determined that we send this forward, but it is an important decision, and we don't have cost estimate examining what it would look like if we give a larger deduction or larger credit the first year people have a policy and a smaller credit in years after, and we could look at a matrix and really see what the range of incentive and cost is.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
Chairman, could we get some sense from the committee as to where they are on the bill as it's written without the dash one?
That's what I asked. What's the sense of the committee?
Chair, we're sort of in the middle of a vote, and I'm just that we're doing votes without voting here.
I asked if there were objections to the dash ones. I got 5 objections to do it. So I was just giving them a little more time here before we kill the dash one. See if anybody wants to really seriously do the dash one, to do the bill as original, or let it die. Which is, Mercury, we're not going to bring this back. This is it. Day of decision. Right now.
Mr. Chair.
Dan Mercury.
In that case, I'd like to do a conceptual amendment.
No. We're in the middle of a vote here. I'm going to drop the gavel on the dash ones right now, and they're going to die. Okay?
Mr. Chairman.
Dan Mercury.
Could we get a sense from the committee as to who will support the bill without the dash ones?
It's what I asked a minute ago. I got a couple of people who said they'd support it. The dash one has failed. Now, we're back to the original bill.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I move House Bill 2080 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Witt moves House Bill 2080 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. More discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rasmussen.
I will be voting against 2080, not because I dislike the policy, I think it's good policy, but because I remain deeply and fundamentally concerned about how many tax credits we've passed out and we seem to be working without context for either a budget or for total credits that we want to work on. And I don't budget my home this way, and I'm frustrated that we seem to be budgeting our state this way.
Okay, other comments?
Mr. Chair,
Shane Berkeley.
I'd like to take us back to the first page of HB 2080, in part to remind myself that I believe it was a 15% tax credit with a ceiling of $500, and again, I'd like to express my interest in having a matrix that could allow us to examine this. It was my understanding we were going to have that. So, I think we're operating in an information deficit here as we attempt to address this.
Okay. For the discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rosenbaum.
I would just say that I appreciate this coming forward. I think part of this bill that's most important couldn't be done without the bill, and that's Section 7 that calls for an outreach campaign. Because it seems to me the most persuasive testimony is when we want people to start at an early age when this insurance is really affordable. I'm not sure that information is getting out, and I would urge people to support the bill to go to the department and ask them to do that anyway.
Okay. Taking a lot of time on this bill, right?
I realize, and I agree that this is a very important concept, and I feel the same way as Representative Merkley, and I'm sorry, I just don't feel comfortable passing something out that I'm not 100% behind. And I would like to see if we could have, and I know we can't, so a matrix of the different options available, so I'm unfortunately, regretfully, going to be voting no.
Motion is to move House Bill 2080 to the floor. Ed, before we do that, Representative Witt, I'd like to see if you would be willing to amend your motion. Going to offer this line 11.
Chair, it occurs that on line 11 and line 17 of the bill, it refers to the employer tax credit. and it doesn't specify that the credit would be offered for long-term care insurance to employees of the taxpayer that work in Oregon, and that may be something that the committee would like to add. It refers generally to taxpayer or to employees of the taxpayer, but not doesn't specify that they ought to be in Oregon.
So specifically, Mr. Chairman?
Specifically, the conceptual amendment would be to add language on line 11 for the period that says that are Oregon employees, and then on line 17 to insert Oregon in between for and employees. So that line would read as the long-term care insurance coverage is for Oregon employees of the taxpayer.
And Mr. Chairman, I would move that we amend my motion to include that language.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rasmussen.
Which motion are we amending?
The motion to move House Bill 2080 to the floor.
And you're applying a conceptual amendment on at the same time?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I suggest we might want to separate out those two motions and go for suspension of the rules.
Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my original motion. I'd like to offer a new motion to conceptually amend House Bill 2080.
First, I have to ask for suspension of the rules. Unanimous consent. Anybody object? Nope. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my motion on House Bill 2080 and offer a conceptual amendment to House Bill 2080 to make it clear that it applies to Oregon employees.
Okay. Representative Witt offers a conceptual amendment that would, on line 11, add the words that are Oregon employees to the end of that line, and on line 17, and the word Oregon in between for an employee, so it reads if the long-term care insurance coverage is for Oregon employees of the taxpayer and their, et cetera.
Mr. Chair?
Any more discussion, Representative Merkley?
If I am employed by a corporation of the state and I am working in another state, am I an Oregon employee or am I not?
Ed?
Representative Merkley, no. I think Oregon employee implies that you work in Oregon.
If I'm working overseas and I'm paying Oregon State income taxes, am I an Oregon employee?
No, Representative Merkley, if you're not working in Oregon, you're an Oregon employee.
Thank you. I would. Sounds like more for the Senate side, but. Quite frankly, if somebody is paying Oregon income taxes, it seems like they ought to qualify and shouldn't be discriminated against because they're outside the state.
Representative Murphy, this conceptual amendment would apply only to the employer portion of the tax credit. So an individual taxpayer who paid Oregon income taxes could apply for the credit. And you see, could buy long-term care insurance and apply for the credit.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Anybody object to the conceptual amendment? It's adopted. Mm-hmm. Just about out of time on this bill. Are there any other motions?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support this bill because I think it's very important that it not die, and I hope on the other side we can get the information that was formally requested and have the type of debate that we should have had here.
Any more discussion? Or actually, we don't have a motion.
Mr. Chairman,
if they would.
I move House Bill 2080 as conceptually amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
If they would, no, move House Bill 2080 as conceptually amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation. Any more discussion? Please call the roll.
Senator Kapori.
No.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Yes. More enthusiasm. Excuse.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative
Rasmussen?
No.
Aye. House Bill 2080 will go to the floor with a due pass, and Representative Witt will be the carrier. Those are the petitions of House Bill 2080. What's next?
lost page 2 of my agenda.
Okay, Mercury, where do we stand on 3560?
Proper check out?
Yes,
sure. I think we're ready to roll on it.
Are you sure? I thought we were ready to roll on the last one.
I'm ready to roll, but there's nobody brought Teddy.
Okay, I'll open the work session. This is Bill 3560, New York City, Mercury.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move HB 3560 to the floor with a group pass recommendation.
Representative Merkley moves House Bill 3560 to the floor with a group pass. Is there any discussion? What's the status of the dash 2?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you for drawing my attention to that. Dash 2 is the intended bill.
Okay. So I withdraw your motion?
Yes, I withdraw my motion.
Senator Merkley withdraws the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Merkley.
I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3560.
Senator Merkley moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3560. Any discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. Now, Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3560 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Merkley moves House Bill 3560 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to briefly discuss it while my colleagues return to the floor. And that is to say simply that what this does is it honors the existing program in which various organizations are put on the checkoff form on the tax form itself. The Dash 2 amendment allows organizations to be placed right into the instructions in a second tier. It will not compete directly with the existing organizations, but give taxpayers a chance to fund other causes that they believe in and that are beneficial to the welfare of the state.
Okay. Any more discussion?
Maybe send the page out in the hallway.
Please okay. Call the roll.
No.
How fully can I speak?
Hi.
Hi.
Excuse. Oh, here he is. Representative Welsh, how do you vote? Keep going, we'll come back to Representative Welsh.
Representative
Williams? Aye. Okay. No. Representative Welsh, how do you vote?
I said I would vote yes.
Yes. All right. The bill, House Bill 3560, is moved to the floor with a two-pass recommendation, and Representative Merkley will carry the bill.
Thank you very much.
The session is closed on House Bill 3560. Okay, I'll open the work session now on House Bill 3595. Get some amendments coming out.
Yeah.
Just barely. A lot of this is monster.
Oh, no, no, no.
Ed, can you tell us about these amendments, please?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I can say that I asked two amendments.
Okay.
The dash two amendments incorporate the dash one, in that they specify that the exemption of the tax is only from the privilege tax, or the tax of privilege of doing business within the city or county. And it inserts that the exemption is for businesses who do not have a place of business located within the geographic boundary of the taxing authority. So it modifies that principal practice first reference that we talked about last time.
Okay, so it deletes that principal practice language, right? It says on line 5, after law, insert a colon, begin a new paragraph, and insert 1. In line 6, delete the period and insert. So that
No, it doesn't delete the principal practice reference because it's modified.
And it says, whose principal engaged in the practice of law, one, whose principal practice is located outside the geographic boundary of the taxing authority, and who does not have a place of business located within the geographic boundary.
That's right.
Representative Witt, does that address your concern?
It does, Mr. Chairman. If you would like, I would move adoption of the dash two amendment to House Bill 3595.
Let's move adoption of dash two amendments, House Bill 3595. More discussion? Representative Witt, this doesn't say you have to have your principal practice in the county, right? In other words, somebody can have a smaller satellite office, right. Principal office can be somewhere else.
Yeah, the way I read it, Mr. Chairman, it says it would apply to taxpayers who do not have a place of business located within the boundary of the taxing authority. So if you have your main office in Seattle and you have a satellite office in Portland, you would not be exempt from the local tax because you have a place of business located within, in this case, within the city of Portland.
Mr. Chair. How would we define a place of business? Is that anywhere in our statute? Would renting a temporary office become a place of business? Mm-hmm. Would renting a hotel room and doing business from that hotel room become a place of business? How do we define place of business?
Mr. Chairman, I would start with Webster's, and beyond that, you know, the courts sometimes have to make distinctions. You don't define every word that goes into a code. I think Mr. Chairman, it's clear what a place of business is.
And
I
gotta hesitate. Yes, think many things in this world. I think you start out thinking it's very clear, and then all of a sudden, we start getting into a free fall on the interpretations of what words actually mean. And oftentimes, those conversations end up in court. Amazingly enough, I would be a lot more comfortable if we had a more clear definition of what a place of business was. I mean, this is an interesting kind of form we're going into.
Okay. Other comments? More discussion? Objections to the dash two amendments?
Yeah, okay.
One, two, three.
Four.
Hertley, Rosenbaum, Safori, and Rasmussen object. Motion is adopted. Do you know where the dash two amendments
come from? Those are mine, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What do these do?
These amendments bring a little bit of, they erase the double standard, which I think is created by House Bill 3595. The dash three amendments include in corporations that are exempt from paying Oregon corporate income tax, exempt corporations which are primarily engaged in the practice of law, in a principal practice which is located outside the state of Oregon. They exempt law offices that are located outside the state of Oregon from paying Oregon state tax. Income tax.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I would imagine the logic behind this is that lawyers apparently need to travel to any number of places in order to do business in a courthouse, and I think that if that's a policy decision for Portland, we should probably go the logical step and make that policy decision for the state of Oregon.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kapori.
I move the dash three amendments to House Bill 3595.
Representative Kapori moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 3595. More discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Representative Williams.
Although I'm extremely tempted to vote in favor of that, I will be voting no in the interest of good public policy.
Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Representative West.
This bill was brought to address a specific issue, a specific concern as it related to attorneys who were, in essence, forced into the city of Portland because the courthouse is located there and thus became subject to Portland's tax. I think what we're doing now is we're blowing this, with these amendments, we blow this bill up into something that's vastly different and vastly bigger than what the original bill was intended to do. Because of that, I'm going to vote against the dash three amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Settling.
Just one comment about the amendments. It exempts corporations that are in these practice of law. There are lots of law firms that are limited liability partnerships and general partnerships and others. So in that respect, I think it actually doesn't achieve an equal playing field. You have different law firms taxed differently depending on how they're organized. But for that matter, I'm trying to maintain a good humor about this bill because I know no matter what we do with it, we're going to end up at the same place at the end of the session, which is in further discussion about this. So in one respect, it's sort of a Seinfeld bill.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Shirley bringing that point up, and I realized I left that out, so I was going to offer a conceptual amendment to take care of that because I really want this to, we're trying to be fair here, and if law, people practicing law outside the city of Portland don't have to pay Portland taxes, then it seems only fair that lawyers whose principal business is outside the state of Oregon should not have to pay Oregon taxes either.
Okay. Well, before we take the time to do a conceptual amendment, let me see who will be supporting the dash three amendment. Let's see that.
Mr. Chair, go ahead. I will be supporting the dash three amendments.
One, two.
I'm making up my mind.
The dash three amendments apparently will not be adopted or taken before. Okay. Any objection to the dash three amendment?
Mm-hmm.
Objection to the dash three amendment? Okay. Dash three amendments are not adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay,
I move House Bill 3595 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Witt moves House Bill 3595 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any more discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would just like to say that this is really a ridiculous bill, and we all know that it's going to end up on the governor's desk with this pen poised in his hand, and I'm not really sure why we're passing it out. I'll be voting no.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay,
we have to pass legislation that we believe is the right legislation, appropriate and fair legislation, irrespective of what the governor might or might not do, and frankly, irrespective of what may or may not happen in the floor or on the Senate. I mean, this is a decision for the nine members on this committee today. I think this bill, as amended, reflects fair and good public policy. And for that reason, I'll be supporting it.
For the discussion,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Rosenbaum,
I respectfully think there are great reasons to vote against this bill regardless of what happened to it when it leaves here. And the primary one for me is that if we pass it, we're carving out an exception for one particular group of citizens when there are lots of other business people similarly situated who simply aren't engaged with the practice of law. And I find it odd that we would want to get lawyers differently and in this case more preferentially than we would other business people. So I will be voting no on either a debate on this.
Can I make one comment, Mr. Chairman? I think the testimony was that attorneys are differently situated. I'm not doing this for attorneys. I'm doing this because attorneys, as an integral part of their practice, have to appear in the courthouse from time to time. Other businesses, as an integral part of their practice, do not have to appear in the city of Portland to do business. And if they are, they can bring forth a bill, and I will support it.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Rickman?
Nothing could be further than the case to say that lawyers are the only ones who have a special circumstance. There are many businesses that have special circumstances, and those were pointed out in testimony, ranging from cabbies who need to take people to the airport and have their primary business in that area, to people who use the Port of Portland. Carving out a special exception, lawyers only, is a very bad road to go down.
Mr. Chair, point of personal privilege, is he saying liars? I thought he said loggers.
That's why I'm supporting that.
I'm not sure why my good colleague made the connection between lawyers and the other term that he just brought forward, but be that as it may, he has more experience than I do in that field. And that being the legal
my vote on the minority report day before yesterday.
That being the legal field I was referring to.
Okay.
And the city of Portland has a very sizable exception so that people who have incidental business in the city of Portland do not pay this tax. And I think that the bases have been well covered. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. For me, fundamentally, I don't care if they exempt all lawyers. I don't care if they exempt everyone who lives 5 feet outside of the city boundary. I find myself every day becoming increasingly angry with our willingness to reach in and tell other governmental agencies their business. I find myself contemplating after exemption bill number 453 that we seem to be passing through, why we even bother having cities and counties any longer, and consequently we'll be voting no.
I think this
bill does raise, it shines a light on an issue that I think deserves looking at, and that's what it's going to get.
Shine a light on Washington.
If the chair wants to move this, I'll support it. Frankly, I think we will have the discussion either with or without the bill. But I'll you'll be on that area.
Please call the roll.
No.
No.
No. I think you should make it, Carrie.
Aye.
Representative Williams? Both aye. Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson? Absolutely, positively. Why are we vote passing out bad legislation? No.
Aye.
If I may, I will go to the floor with the pass. Representative Witt will be the carry-on. Close the work session for 3595. We have a carry-on for 2080. I think we did. Pardon? Yeah. Does anybody remember? Were you the carry-on?
Yeah, I both think you remember.
Okay,
due to the shortness of time, we're going to move Senate Bill 718 to another day, and we'll open work sessions on House Bill 2082 and House Bill 3344. Somebody should have said something. Okay, Dick, we have a lot of ground to cover on both of these bills. So why don't we start with 2082 and the most recent amendments.
Okay.
Members, I'd like to call your attention to the fact that this is the proposed transportation gas tax package. It has the dash 18 amendments now that I'd like you to operate on. We're not going to move this bill or 3344 today, but I would like to move them both on Monday. So I'd like you to take the weekend to talk to anybody that you need to, raise any questions, analyze the amendments, and be prepared to take action on these on Monday. Dick, maybe you can just point out what the differences are between the dash 18s and the dash 17s.
Okay, Mr. Chair. First of all, there is one summary sheet kind of in your materials, which I've kind of laid out just for your reference in terms of what is actually in the dash 18 amendment. Now, how are they different than the dash 17? So, I can't
answer that. The dash 18s contain this. And correct me if I'm wrong when I go through.
Sure.
It dedicates, it has 2 cents starting in January 2000 going to bonding for a 20-year project and raising approximately $600 million. Is that total difference?
I believe that's the same total.
Okay. $600 million for projects. The projects that are to be undertaken will be presented to the emergency board, to the legislature, no later than February 1st, 2000, and they will be based on the statewide STIP. And we will have a list of what those projects are from ODOT by region and by priority. Secondly, we'll have 4 cents that goes to cities and counties the first 2 years with a 60-40 split to counties first and cities. And after 2 years, the split on that 4 cents goes to 50-30-20. We'll have a $10 vehicle registration fee for the biennium, $5 a year, split 50-30-20. We will include the small cities program at $1 million, small counties at $750,000, Eastern Oregon Safety Net at $3 million off the top. I have a $10 vehicle registration fee annually for high growth counties that would go to the counties, and that the priority in Multnomah County is to the Willamette River bridges. We'll start the another 2 cents beginning October 1st or 90 days after the close of the session. I don't think any of us have this. 90 days after the close of the session, and that will go to a state maintenance and preservation fund. And that's, in essence, the program. The weight mile, comparable weight mile table that have to be included in the bill are based on the new highway cost allocation study, both in terms of their proportion for light vehicles and heavy vehicles, and on their distribution of expenses within the heavy vehicle class. Did I miss anything?
I believe you covered it. Sure.
Okay. Are there any questions or discussion?
we've all been talked to repeatedly about this. This is a dramatic package for the benefit of Oregon, and look forward to its passage. Justin, do you
have? I've handed out to you, I hope you have this, sort of an analysis of the Dash 18 Amendment. And so I thought we could quickly run through that, so if you're looking at it over the weekend, maybe you won't have as many questions.
Okay.
The first page is similar to the one we had before, just on the engrossed version of the bill. It starts out with the current law of revenues at the top, and you see in the next to the last line of that section that the heavy vehicle share would be going up over time if you make no changes. So it increases from like 37.9 to 39.4. If you adopt the recommendations of the highway cost allocation study, you would drop that heavy vehicle share to 36.2, and that would hold then over the years 2001 and out as far as I forecasted. What that does is reduce particularly the weight mile tax rate and the revenue that's coming from the heavy vehicle share. So you've kind of got, in a sense, two straw men as to what you compare the Dash 18 lens against, whether you compare it with current law or with what would be recommended, I guess, as changes without any tax rate increases to accommodate the findings in the highway cost allocation study. So that I call the adjusted current law. All right. Then in the middle there is just a brief array of the revenues that are generated by the 6-cent fuel tax increase and the $10 basic registration fee increase. And then at the bottom, again, two straw men in terms of what the distributions are of these revenues, current law and adjusted current law. And at the very bottom, the registration fees, mainly because I'm using those numbers later on. Page 2, then, at the top, again, a summary of what the changes are in the Dash 18 amendments. And then the revenues, the total amount of revenues that would be flowing into the highway fund as a result of the Dash 18 amendments, basically divided into current law, which is the amount that would come from the adjusted forecast in this case, and the increase as a result of the increase in the tax rates. The distribution percentage then is 36.2. If you look at heavy vehicles, the second item in that revenue section, the current distribution is at 36.2%. Okay, that's the current highway cost allocation heavy vehicle share. But it's different for state revenues, for state programs, expenditures on state highways, and for expenditures on local highways. So as you change the distribution of the new money, I weight those two different to get a little different heavy vehicle share. And you can see the new distribution goes out at 31.2 for 2 years. And then as the distribution changes again, it goes back up to about 33.5. So that total there under heavy vehicles is what they have to raise, what needs to be raised from the heavy vehicles through all of the fees, the registration fee, the weight mile taxes, permits, and so on, if they're going to meet their cost responsibility share as it's determined there. Then I subtract off the fuel tax that comes out of the forecast and the registration fees for heavy vehicles. There's no change, so I've adjusted those for the recommended changes for vehicles below 26,000. And you end up with what you need from the weight mile tax. Run through some calculations. The last number there is 122.8%. That's how much I have to increase the existing weight mile tax rates to generate those weight mile dollars. Another new item you see in there just before the end of the total heavy vehicle is discount. The first two numbers there are the 65% and 3%. Simply how I allocate, or what percentage I assume of heavy vehicles will either use the electronic filing provision or use transponders. And so those discounts are out through there. They're 2% reduction in weight mile taxes if a majority of the fleet uses transponders, and a 1% discount against weight mile taxes if you're filing electronically. So then you get the distribution of those revenues, again, to the current law revenues and the new revenues as they're going out. One item in the middle of the page, you might wonder where the $7,602,000 comes in, which is basically 2 cents for 3 months. Okay, that's implementing the tax in October, the 3 months going, the revenues from that increase going to the state only for those 3 months. Let me speak for a minute. You may wonder what equivalent revenue is, as it's laid out in these tables. Essentially, you have increases in the basic vehicle taxes. The equivalent revenues, then, are the increases that are required from the heavy vehicle sector to match those increases and maintain their cost responsibility share. Now, those equivalent revenues, then, are distributed out proportionately with the increase in the fuel taxes and the registration fees. So when the distribution of registration fees down here, for example, is more than just registration fees because it includes a part of the weight mile taxes, the rate of use assessment fee, and the flat fees that are paid by heavy vehicles. You've got some comparisons there before bonding, and at the bottom you've got a section which shows the revenues that this Dash 18 amendments would raise for bonding. That's the 2 cents plus equivalent weight mile taxes being dedicated to the state for the purposes of bonding. The next page is simply the weight mile tax rates, the road use assessment fee, and the flat fees. And if I may take just a moment to respond to Representative Merkley's question before about the road use assessment fees. In general, if you look at the five-axle group there, we find there is no VMT currently in that group. And I would, you know, if you want to adopt the road use assessment fee, I would suggest dropping the five-axle category. As to why for the 6, 7, 8, and 9 axles, they're higher than the weight mile tax rates, they are and they should be. The weight mile tax rates are based on operating weights. So while the vehicle may be registered at 98,000, when you compute those rates, you're arraying those actual operating weights downward, essentially, and getting a lower average weight. Where the road use assessment fee, you're paying for the load you're actually carrying. The next page, and the next three pages, are bonding scenarios. And here, I'm a little bit out of my ballpark, but I tried to kind of lay out what's involved. The revenue stream is basically starts with the numbers off of the other page in terms of what the program generates for bonding. And I determined about a 2.6% annual growth for the 4 years that are in that estimate. And I've just extended that same growth rate out to 20 years. Or 26 years, I guess, and that's the revenue stream that you get over that period, which is called the dedicated revenue. Okay, the next four columns, I've assumed issues. Now, when the department will actually issue bonds depends on how soon it can get, you know, projects underway, and it may issue them sooner, it may issue them later. I think this schedule is probably slower than the. The chair has hoped, but it also is, unless, you know, some changes can be made, I think it's not unrealistic. What I compute then is the debt service required for each of those bond issues, and that's what you get in the first sheet. It's over 20 years, and the first bond issue is $50 million, then $100 million, and $200 million, and then the last one is whatever it needs to get us to $600 net of issue costs. So you deduct all of those payments then for debt service, and you're left with a balance. Now, what that's suggesting, you know, is that you would build up over this 24-year period about $900 million of monies which you couldn't spend. I need to look some more at that question in terms of when you pledge these monies to bonds, you know, is what can be done, okay? And I will talk to the treasurer about that, and you know, maybe as lawyers you can help me out.
I'm not a lawyer.
It also suggests that ODOT would have some freedom in this scheme to go to a shorter bonding period, 15 years or something, to maybe push this up because there's more money than would be needed. Also, the bill actually has $2.05 for bonding. It suggests that, you know, if you want to just make it two, you probably got enough money to raise the $600 million. So the second sheet then says, okay, let's stick with that type of scenario, but drop it to a 15-year bond. As you can see, that would the payoff period would end essentially by 2018, 2019, I guess, and the excess revenues are considerably smaller. The third sheet then says, okay, could we really get some more money out of this income stream in terms of bonding? I bumped it up another $100 million, so you go to $700 million. And if you stick with a 15-year, you start getting, you know, I would say, you know, if you play around with a little bit more, you can get some negative cash flows in there. So you're kind of pushing the limits of what you can actually do in that too soon. The last page, then, is simply a summary of all of these programs, what money is going. Let me make a quick comment. Under state there, you find current law, adjusted current law, and then House Bill 2082A-18. And then I say increase over CL and ACL. Okay, acronyms, I'm sorry, but, you know, just I don't have room. So it's current law and adjusted current law. I think the rest of this table is self-explanatory. In the box at the bottom are the current law distributions. These are after adjusting for the small county and small city allotments, so they don't exactly match the 6005 and so on. But you can compare those with what would happen under 2082A. And at the bottom, again, for the first time, I'm showing an estimate of what the local registration fees would raise for those counties. And there's nothing in the bill that says how that's distributed. It says the cities and counties will work together to work out a distribution formula. Okay, thank you, Dick.
Mr. Chairman.
Lieutenant Williams.
First, I want to thank Dick for an extremely cogent presentation on how this would come together. And secondly, Dick, I want your home phone number this week. Explain it all to me again when I look at it.
986-1265. Yeah.
You're right.
I'm trying to find you. It's not home.
All right. Let's take the rest of the time we have and go through the remaining amendments on 3344.
You need to hurry and get through these, Mr. Chair, because I keep adding new ones. Okay, according to my sorting of papers here, we're on the -17 amendments, which deal with page 20 of the bill. And while we're looking at the 20, at the 17th, let's also look at the 21s. They basically deal with the same issue. And that is the, the road use assessment fee we've been talking about here. In line 40, well, starting in line 42, it says the road use assessment fee will be $3 per ton over the maximum weight allowable in ORS 818010. That's basically not workable. It's not what was, I think, the desired result of the people submitting the bill, opposing the bill. And trying to get to what was intended, the -17 amendments simply say if the weight is over $98,000, it's for $2 per ton over that weight. Yes, $98,000 pounds. And then the -21 amendments, there's another way you could go there, which is simply to restore the original language. I haven't prepared an amendment for that. Leave this as a weight and mileage sensitive tax as opposed to making it simply a state sensitive tax. But the alternative also would be to incorporate again from the highway cost allocation study the contractor's recommendation that you move to a table rather than a single 5.2 cents per axle for the equal tax. So that's what the 21 amendment is. Moving on then to the 19-19 amendment. This deals with the trip permit issue. And again, the 19 and 22 amendments, A-22 amendments, propose alternative solutions. The 19 really comes from the Department of Transportation, and they're suggesting that you reduce that $42 permit fee from 5 days to 3 days, which makes it consistent with the permit earlier for diesel fuel, which is a 3-day permit. It also makes it closer to charging an amount which is equal to the registration fees which would be paid if you use, if you register in a state and run, then you can run all year. And you're paying whatever it is, $4,000, $4,700 is the top registration fee. Or, you could get 73, I think it is, 5-day permits for $43, and it costs you a whole lot less. So to try and bring those two into alignment, one way is to just reduce the number of days, and that does bring us fairly close to, so if you make it a 3-day permit. In my amendments, which are the 22, I had addressed that same issue, and I'd left the one-day permit rate in, but increased it, changed it to, again, make the two consistent at $15. Again, if the three-day rate is 42, then 15 for one day is about comparable.
And so it's an either-or then on those two?
Yes. The -820 amendments really on page 35 is where the amendment is. The amendment on page 1 is essentially to assert the new statute that's been amended. So on page 35, you're simply inserting into the text here new section 59A. I guess that's all, 59A. And what these do is allow waymasters to be able to essentially perform police functions in terms of being able to actually arrest people when they're overweight or violating when they're being overweight.
This is a Jimmy Craig section.
Boy, they'll be cruising the truck stop.
I'm sorry, but we have to confiscate that quarter pounder.
And I'm not really prepared to make an argument for or against those. I think if you're interested, we should have ODOT address why they want those amendments in the bill.
Okay.
The A-23 amendments again deal with page 47. And this is just a problem that I pointed out the first time through. And at the bottom of the page in line 44, it says that the inventory tax will be imposed on the effective date of the tax. When you want that tax imposed is the day that the new diesel tax is imposed.
Right.
And so you change it to the operative date. On page 44, then, the 824 amendments, line 34, this is a minor adjustment there. Throughout this section, it addresses taxes or fees, and I think it should also address taxes or fees there. The 825 amendments, now are more substantive, what they're saying. If we go back on page 25, you have an exemption your new registration fees come in two forms, what's called a fixed fee and a variable fee. And some types of vehicles are have to pay the whole fee, and other vehicles pay just the fixed plus $500, and then the low-mileage vehicles pay just the fixed fee, which is roughly, it's a little less than 20% of the total. This would add, as a part of the low-mileage vehicles, another section which says, regard the section on low mileage, to get that, you have to be under 60,000 pounds. So if you're under 60,000 pounds and you run less than 30,000 miles, you only have to pay the fixed fee. This would say, regardless of your weight, if you run less than 5,000 miles, you only have to pay the fixed fee. The A26 now, which is a new one handed out today, if you have it in order, is a policy statement, which would be, I guess that goes in section 49, or page 49, somewhere in the bill here, I'm looking at line 22. So above section 84, you would insert a new section 83A, and that's a statement of legislative policy, essentially, that responsibility that the heavy vehicle should pay heavy vehicle share of the cost of, as determined by the highway cost allocation study, that a study should be done once every 2 years, and that the rates should be adjusted so that heavy vehicles do in fact pay their share.
Mr. Chair?
Okay, William.
Dick, is there any, I'm just interested in the word should being used here. From a kind of lawyerly drafting perspective, the word should and shall kind of mean two different things in the legislative process.
Representative Williams, perhaps I can address that. I requested this amendment, and it was the advice of legislative counsel that when you put a policy statement in, that it does use the should language, and if you're doing statutes, then you will do the shall. And what I wanted to do was to have this section be included so that future legislatures who are considering any kind of adjustments to this would see our intent is that we want to make sure that light vehicles and heavy vehicles are still analyzed and proportionately are paying their appropriate fair share, but we can go ahead and put that in statute, but this is a policy statement, not a statutory directive.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Jim Merkley.
I think this is a good policy statement. I have prepared a very similar amendment. I also prepared an amendment that says we shall, that it's not a policy statement, but actually just says that we shall conduct a allocation study every 2 years so that we essentially make that a part of the plan to go forward, recognizing that future legislatures could change that, but it would unless changed, then we would have those studies.
Do we have a copy of that?
I have a copy here to pass out.
Dick, there's already, I believe you said in researching this, there's already some language that suggests this. Maybe you can tell us upon what basis does ODOT do this study over to you?
There is a statement in statute, 366, 4F 366, and I did not bring that citation with me. But it talks about a cost responsibility study and talks about it being performed. And I guess I don't have a copy of that. I should get a copy and present it to
you. Okay.
One last amendment there, the dash 28 on page 24 again. The highway, the recommendations of the highway cost allocation study could be incorporated into this bill by modifying those registration fees below $26,000. So instead of going from 15 through 245 there, they essentially would start out at 20 and then increase 80. 110 would be replaced by 80, 125 by 135, 140 by 160, and the rest replaced by 230 in terms of the recommendation by the contract. We do not have it.
I was hoping to suggest to Dr. Yates that while he was relaxing in his weekend retreat, that if he wanted to draw up some sort of chart of each amendment and their interrelationship with each other, it would be helpful.
I plan to do some charting.
Thank you.
Barbara, would you have us excused from the floor for a few minutes? Mr. Russell? We're looking at 8828.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. And I'd like to just comment briefly on the amendments that we've been reviewing. Most of them we're absolutely fine with, and we appreciate the fine work of Mr. Yates and the Department of Transportation in even further improving our bill. Let me go through them quickly. The dash 9s are fine, the dash 10s, dash 11s, 12s, 13s,
18. It's an either or on those, right? 13 or 18.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We prefer the 18.
Okay.
The 14s are fine. 15. 16. 17. 19s and the 22s, we prefer the 22s, which retains the one-day permit that was specifically requested by a firm in Eastern Oregon. The 20s are fine. 23s.
Even though you might catch overweight truckers.
Even though we might catch overweight truckers. Because we're relying more on the registration fees, this gives ODOT additional authority to enforce those provisions, and we think that's warranted. 23s are fine. 24s are fine. The dash 8s. The dash 8s and the dash 14s, my understanding is that those are in House Bill 2190. And we would prefer that that bill proceed on its own merits. If that bill passes, then we would amend this bill with conflict amendments to conform it to 2190. So we would prefer that these, the dash 8s and the dash 14s, not be adopted at this time. With the understanding that if 2190 passes, we will conform this bill to that bill. We do not prefer the dash 21s, that approach to the road use assessment fee. We prefer the ODOT suggested change that just clarifies that it applies over 98,000 pounds.
Just a second, Bob. Did you talk about, do we have 21 dash?
We're talking about with another one.
17. Yes, 17. 17. Say that again, Bob, what you just said.
We prefer the dash 17s versus the dash 21s, which are an alternative choice.
Okay.
There was a third option there, Bob. Restore the original.
Right.
Yeah, I'll do prefer the dash 17. And the dash 25, the only concern that we have about those, which provides lower registration vehicle fees for vehicles that are operating less than 5,000 miles a year, and we don't know what the revenue impact of that is, and we would like to know that before we take a position on those amendments. We have a couple of provisions of the trip permit provision, for example, works for most of those folks who are operating less than 5,000 miles a year, so that they're not paying the high registration fees. And we would just like to compare the revenue impact and see which works best for those particular folks.
Okay.
We have not seen any amendments passed the dash 25. We would like to have the opportunity to look at the 26s and 28s. I didn't hear anything about 27s.
I don't know where there's 27s. You also might want to look at Representative Mercury's dash 4s, which seem to be sort of a rewritten version of the policy statement in the dash 26, only with shalls rather than shoulds.
I would like to look at those over the weekend, and we'll let you know how we feel about them on Monday.
That's okay. That's good. That's what the plan is. Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Appreciate your work today, and we'll get into this on Monday. Do you have anything else to add, Dick?
No.
Okay. Good. See you Monday. We're adjourned.
Yeah, have a good weekend, Dick.
You don't have to order.